those holding political power, whether Clinton or his Republican predecessors, had something in common. They sought to keep their power by diverting the anger of citizens to groups without the resources to defend themselves. As H.L. Mencken, the acerbic social critic of the 1920s, put it, "The whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed by menacing it with an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary." Criminals were among these hobgoblins, also immigrants, people on welfare, and certain governments, Iraq, North Korea, Cuba. By turning attention to them, by inventing or exaggerating their dangers, the failures of the American system could be concealed. Immigrants were a convenient object of attack, because as non-voters, their interests could be safely ignored. It was easy for politicians to play upon the xenophobia that has erupted from time to time in American history, the anti-Irish prejudices of the mid-19th century, the continual violence against Chinese who had been brought in to work on the railroads, the hostility toward immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe that led to the restrictive immigration laws of the 1920s. The reform spirit of the 60s had led to an easing of restrictions on immigration, but in the 90s, Democrats and Republicans alike played on the economic fears of working Americans. Jobs were being lost because corporations were firing employees to save money, downsizing, or moving plants out of the country to more profitable situations. Immigrants, especially the large numbers coming over the southern border from Mexico, were blamed for taking jobs from citizens of the United States, for receiving government benefits, for causing higher taxes on American citizens. Both major political parties joined to pass legislation, which Clinton then signed, to remove welfare benefits, food stamps, payments to elderly and disabled people, from not only illegal, but legal immigrants. By early 1997, letters were going out to close to 1 million legal immigrants who were poor, old, or disabled, warning them that their food stamps and cash payments would be cut off in a few months unless they became citizens. For perhaps 500,000 legal immigrants, passing the tests required for becoming a citizen was quite impossible. They could not read English, were sick or disabled, or just too old to learn. An immigrant from Portugal living in Massachusetts told a reporter through an interpreter, "Every day we are afraid the letter will come. What will we do if we lose our checks? We will starve. Oh my God, it will not be worth living." Illegal immigrants, fleeing poverty in Mexico, began to face harsher treatment in the early 90s. Thousands of border guards were added. A Reuters dispatch from Mexico City, April 3, 1997, said about the tougher policy, "Any crackdown against illegal immigration automatically angers Mexicans, millions of whom migrate legally and illegally across the 2,000-mile border to the United States in search of jobs each year." Hundreds of thousands of Central Americans who had fled death squads in Guatemala and El Salvador while the United States was giving military aid to those governments now faced deportation because they had never been deemed political refugees. To admit that these cases were political would have given a lie to U.S. claims at the time that those repressive regimes were improving their human rights record and therefore deserved to continue receiving military aid. In early 1996, the Congress and the President joined to pass an Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, allowing deportation of any immigrant ever convicted of a crime, no matter how long ago or how serious. Lawful permanent residents who had married Americans and now had children were not exempt. The New York Times reported that July that hundreds of long-term legal residents have been arrested since the law passed. The new government policy toward immigrants, far from fulfilling Clinton's promise of a new government for a new century, was a throwback to the notorious alien and sedition laws of the 18th century and the McCarthy-era McCarran-Walter Act of the 1950s. It was hardly in keeping with the grand claim inscribed on the Statue of Liberty, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." In the summer of 1996, apparently seeking the support of centrist voters for the coming election, Clinton signed a law to end the federal government's guarantee, created under the New Deal, of financial help to poor families with dependent children. This was called welfare reform, and the law itself had the deceptive title of Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996. Its aim was to force poor families receiving federal cash benefits, many of them single mothers with children, to go to work by cutting off their benefits after 2 years, limiting lifetime benefits to 5 years, and allowing people without children to get food stamps for only 3 months in any 3-year period. The Los Angeles Times reported, "As legal immigrants lose access to Medicaid and families battle a new 5-year limit on cash benefits, health experts anticipate a resurgence of tuberculosis and sexually transmitted diseases. The aim of the welfare cuts was to save $50 billion over a 5-year period, less than the cost of a planned new generation of fighter planes." Even the New York Times, a supporter of Clinton during the election, said that the provisions of the new law have nothing to do with creating work, but everything to do with balancing the budget by cutting programs for the poor. There was a simple but overwhelming problem with cutting off benefits to the poor that forced them to find jobs. There were not jobs available for all those who would lose their benefits. In New York City, in 1990, when 2,000 jobs were advertised in the sanitation department at $23,000 a year, 100,000 people applied. 2 years later in Chicago, 7,000 people showed up for 550 jobs at Stouffer's, a restaurant chain. In Joliet, Illinois, 2,000 showed up at Commonwealth Edison at 4:30 a.m. to apply for jobs that did not yet exist. In early 1997, 4,000 people lined up for 700 jobs at the Roosevelt Hotel in Manhattan. It was estimated that at the existing rate of job growth in New York, with 470,000 adults on welfare, it would take 24 years to absorb those thrown off the rolls. What the Clinton administration steadfastly refused to do was to establish government programs to create jobs, as had been done in the New Deal era, when billions were spent to give employment to several million people, from construction workers and engineers to artists and writers. "The era of big government is over," Clinton proclaimed as he ran for president, seeking votes on the supposition that Americans supported the Republican position that government was spending too much for social programs. But both parties were misreading public opinion. The press was often complicit in this. When, in the mid-year election of 1994, only 37% of the electorate went to the polls, and slightly more than half voted Republican, the media reported this as a revolution. A headline in the New York Times read, "Public shows trust in GOP Congress," suggesting that the American people were supporting the Republican agenda of less government. But in the story below that headline, a New York Times CBS News public opinion survey found that 65% of those polled said that it is the responsibility of government to take care of people who can't take care of themselves. Clinton and the Republicans, in joining against big government, were aiming only at social services. The other manifestations of big government, huge contracts to military contractors, and generous subsidies to corporations, continued at exorbitant levels. Big government had, in fact, begun with the Founding Fathers, who deliberately set up a strong central government to protect the interests of the bondholders, the slave owners, the land speculators, the manufacturers. For the next 200 years, the American government continued to serve the interests of the wealthy and powerful, offering millions of acres of free land to the railroads, setting high tariffs to protect manufacturers, giving tax breaks to oil corporations, and using its armed forces to suppress strikes and rebellions. It was only in the 20th century, especially in the 30s and 60s, when the government, besieged by protests and fearful of the stability of the system, passed social legislation for the poor, that political leaders and business executives complained about big government. President Clinton reappointed Alan Greenspan as head of the Federal Reserve System, which regulated interest rates. Greenspan's chief concern was to avoid inflation, which bondholders did not want because it would reduce their profits. His financial constituency saw higher wages for workers as producing inflation, and worried that if there was not enough employment, wages might rise. Reduction of the annual deficit in order to achieve a balanced budget became an obsession of the Clinton administration. But since Clinton did not want to raise taxes on the wealthy or to cut funds for the military, the only alternative was to sacrifice the poor, the children, the aged, to spend less for health care, for food stamps, for education, for single mothers. Two examples of this appeared early in Clinton's second administration, in the spring of 1997. From the New York Times, May 8, 1997. A major element of President Clinton's education plan, a proposal to send $5 billion to repair the nation's crumbling schools, was among the items quietly killed in last week's agreement to balance the federal budget. From the Boston Globe, May 22, 1997. After White House intervention, the Senate yesterday rejected a proposal to extend health insurance to the nation's 10.5 million uninsured children. Seven lawmakers switched their votes after senior White House officials called and said the amendment would imperil the delicate budget agreement. Meanwhile, the government was continuing to spend at least $250 billion a year to maintain the military machine. The assumption was that the nation must be ready to fight two regional wars simultaneously. However, after the Soviet Union collapsed in 1989, Bush's Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney, hardly a dove, said, "The threats have become remote, so remote that they are difficult to discern." The government, Republicans and Democrats agreeing, was going ahead with a program to build F-22 fighter planes that would cost at least $70 billion. The Associated Press reported estimates by the General Accounting Office that the entire Joint Strike Fighter program would eventually cost $1 trillion. The use of force was still central to U.S. foreign policy. Clinton had been in office barely 6 months when he sent the Air Force to drop bombs on Baghdad, presumably in retaliation for an assassination plot against George Bush on the occasion of the former president's visit to Kuwait. The evidence for such a plot was very weak, coming as it did from the notoriously corrupt Kuwaiti police. Nevertheless, U.S. planes claiming to target intelligence headquarters in the Iraqi capital bombed a suburban neighborhood, killing at least six people, including a prominent artist and her husband. Columnist Molly Ivins suggested that the asserted purpose of the bombing of Baghdad, sending a powerful message, fit the definition of terrorism. The maddening thing about terrorists is that they are indiscriminate in their acts of vengeance or cries for attention or whatever. What is true for individuals must also be true of nations. The United States continued to supply lethal arms to some of the most vicious regimes in the world. Indonesia had a record of mass murder, having killed perhaps 200,000 out of a population of 700,000 in its invasion and occupation of East Timor. Yet the Clinton administration approved the sale of F-16 fighter planes and other assault equipment to Indonesia. The Boston Globe wrote, "The arguments presented by senators solicitous of Suharto's regime and of defense contractors, oil companies and mining concerns doing business with Jakarta-made Americans, seem a people willing to overlook genocide for the sake of commerce." In 1996, the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to José Ramos Horta of East Timor. Speaking at a church in Brooklyn shortly before he won the prize, Ramos Horta said, "In the summer of 1977, I was here in New York when I received a message telling me that one of my sisters, Maria, 21 years old, had been killed in an aircraft bombing. The aircraft, named Bronco, was supplied by the United States. Within months, another report about a brother, Guy, 17 years old, killed along with many other people in his village by Bell helicopters, supplied by the United States. Same year, another brother, Nunu, captured and executed with an American-made M-16. Similarly, American-made Sikorsky helicopters were used by Turkey to destroy the villages of rebellious Kurds in what writer John Terman, Spoils of War, The Human Cost of the Arms Trade, called a campaign of terror against the Kurdish people. By early 1997, the United States was selling more arms abroad than all other nations combined. Lawrence Korb, a Department of Defense official under Reagan but later a critic of arms sales, wrote, "It has become a money game, an absurd spiral in which we export arms only to have to develop more sophisticated ones to counter those spread out all over the world." Human rights clearly came second to business profit in U.S. foreign policy. When the international group Human Rights Watch issued its 1996 annual report, the New York Times, December 5, 1996, summarized its findings. The organization strongly criticized many powerful nations, particularly the United States, accusing them of failing to press governments in China, Indonesia, Mexico, Nigeria, and Saudi Arabia to improve human rights for fear of losing access to lucrative markets. A similar concern for profit over human rights was evident in policy toward the new Russia that emerged from the exploded Soviet Union. Anxious to steer Russia toward capitalism, and in the process to open it up as a market for American goods, the U.S. government simply overlooked the bullying policies of Russian President Boris Yeltsin. The Clinton administration firmly supported Yeltsin, even after Russia initiated a brutal invasion and bombardment of the outlying region of Chechnya, which wanted independence. The historic use of economic aid to gain political influence was underlined when, in November 1993, an Associated Press dispatch reported the phasing out of economic aid to 35 countries, most of them very poor. The administrator for the Agency for International Development, J. Brian Atwood, explained, "We no longer need an AID program to purchase influence." The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, both dominated by the United States, adopted a hard-nosed banker's approach to debt-ridden third-world countries. They insisted that these poor nations allocate a good part of their meager resources to repaying loans to the rich countries at the cost of cutting social services to their already desperate populations. Foreign economic policy was presumably based on free trade agreements, most notably those signed with Canada and Mexico. Democrats and Republicans, enthusiastically supported by corporate interests, joined to pass the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, which Clinton signed. Labor unions opposed it because it meant businesses would be free to move across borders to find workers who would work at lower wages under poor conditions. The claim of free trade was hardly to be believed, since U.S. policy was to interfere with trade when it served certain political or economic ends, although the phrase always used was national interest. Thus, the United States went to lengths to prevent tomato growers in Mexico from entering the U.S. market and put pressure on Thailand to open its markets to American tobacco companies, even while at home, mounting public protest led to restrictions on the sale of tobacco. In an even more flagrant violation of the principle of free trade, the United States would not allow shipments of food or medicine to Iraq or to Cuba, the result being the deaths of tens of thousands of children. In 1996, on the television program 60 Minutes, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Madeleine Albright, was asked about the report that 500,000 children have died as a result of sanctions against Iraq. "That is more children than died in Hiroshima. Is the price worth it?" Albright replied, "I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it." The United States, with 5% of the Earth's population, consumed 30% of what was produced worldwide. But only a tiny portion of the American population benefited. This richest 1% of the population saw its wealth increase enormously starting in the late 1970s. As a result of changes in the tax structure, by 1995, that richest 1% had gained over $1 trillion and now owned over 40% of the nation's wealth. According to the business magazine Forbes, the 400 richest families owned $92 billion in 1982. 13 years later, this had jumped to $480 billion. The Dow Jones average of stock prices had gone up 400% between 1980 and 1995, while the average wage of workers had declined in purchasing power by 15%. It was therefore possible to say that the U.S. economy was healthy, but only if you considered the richest part of the population. Meanwhile, 40 million people were without health insurance, and infants died of sickness and malnutrition at a rate higher than that of any other industrialized country. For people of color, the statistics were worse. Infants died at twice the rate of white children, and the life expectancy of a black man in Harlem, according to a United Nations report, was 46 years, less than that in Cambodia or the Sudan. The United States, forgetting or choosing to forget the disastrous consequence of such a policy in the 20s, was consigning its people to the mercy of the free market. The market did not care about the environment or the arts, and it left many Americans without jobs or health care, without a decent education for their children, or adequate housing. Under Reagan, the government had reduced the number of housing units getting subsidies from 400,000 to 40,000. In the Clinton administration, the program ended altogether. Despite Clinton's 1997 inaugural day promise of a new government, there was no bold program to take care of these needs. Such a program would require huge expenditures of money. There were two ways of raising this money, but the Clinton administration, like its predecessors, was not inclined to turn to them, given the powerful influence of corporate wealth. One of those sources was the wealth of the super rich. Taxing very high incomes at post-World War II levels, that is, at 70% to 90% instead of at 37%, could make available several $100 billion a year. In addition, a wealth tax, something not yet done as national policy, but perfectly feasible, could retrieve the $1 trillion gained by the super rich over the years in tax breaks. The other major source of funds was the military budget. During the 1992 presidential campaign, Randall Forsberg, an expert on military expenditures, had suggested a military budget of $60 billion to be achieved over a number of years would support a demilitarized U.S. foreign policy appropriate to the needs and opportunities of the post-Cold War world. Instead, in 1996, the United States was spending more money on the military than the rest of the world combined, 4 times as much as Russia, 8 times as much as China, 40 times as much as North Korea, 80 times as much as Iraq. It was a bizarre waste of the nation's wealth. A radical reduction of the military budget would require a renunciation of war, a refusal to use military solutions for international disputes. It would speak to the fundamental human desire, overwhelmed too often by barrages of super patriotic slogans, to live at peace with others. The public appeal for such a dramatic policy change would be based in a simple but powerful moral argument, that given the nature of modern warfare, the victims, by a ratio of 10 to 1, have been civilians. To put it another way, war in our time is always a war against children. And if the children of other countries are to be granted an equal right to life with our own children, then we must use our extraordinary human ingenuity to find non-military solutions for world problems. With the $400 or $500 billion gained by progressive taxation and demilitarization, there would be funds available to pay for health care for everyone, to guarantee jobs to anyone willing and able to work. Instead of giving out contracts for jet bombers and nuclear submarines, contracts could be offered to non-profit corporations to hire people to build homes, construct public transport systems, clean up the rivers and lakes, turn our cities into decent places to live. One of Marge Piercy's poems ends with, "The pitcher cries for water to carry, and a person for work that is real." The alternative to such a bold program was to continue as before, allowing the cities to fester, forcing rural people to face debt and foreclosures, offering no useful work for the young, creating a larger and larger marginal population of desperate people. Many of these people would turn to drugs and crime, some of them to a religious fanaticism ending in violence against others or themselves. In 1996, one such group committed mass suicide. Some to a hysterical hatred of government, as in the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City in 1995, killing at least 168 people. The response of the authorities to such signs of desperation, anger, alienation, has been, historically, quite predictable. Build more jails, lock up more people, execute more prisoners, and continue with the same policies that produced the desperation. But another scenario remained possible, one that envisioned a time somewhere around the beginning of the new millennium, when citizens would organize to demand what the Declaration of Independence promised, a government that protected the equal right of everyone to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This meant economic arrangements that distributed the national wealth rationally and humanely. This meant a culture where the young no longer were taught to strive for success as a mask for greed. By the mid-90s, the elements for such a scenario were there. Public opinion surveys showed the public much more inclined than either major party to curtail the military budget, tax the rich, clean up the environment, have universal health care, end poverty. And in the 90s, there were thousands of groups in cities and towns all over the country already working for such goals. But they had not yet united into a national movement. Still, there were signs of such a possibility. In 1995, 1 million black men gathered in the nation's capital to express their solidarity around common frustrations. The following year, 500,000 adults and children of all colors arrived in Washington to stand for children. The country was becoming more diverse, more Latino people, more Asians, more interracial marriages. There was at least a chance for a true rainbow coalition, one that would fulfill the promise proclaimed by black leader Jesse Jackson. In the late 80s, speaking for the poor and dispossessed of all colors, Jackson gave the nation a brief, rare surge of political excitement. The culture had been affected by the movements of the 60s in a way that could not be obliterated. There was a distinctly new consciousness manifested in the cinema, on television, in the world of music, an awareness that women deserved equal rights, that the sexual preferences of men and women were their own affair, that the growing gap between rich and poor gave the lie to the word democracy. The labor movement was showing signs of a new energy, moving to organize white-collar workers, farm workers, immigrant workers, and to tap the idealism of young people by inviting them to help in this organizing. Employees were blowing the whistle on corporate crimes. Religious leaders, who had been quiet since their involvement in the movements for civil rights and against the Vietnam War, began to speak out on economic equality. In the summer of 1996, the New York Times reported, "More than at any other time in decades, religious leaders are making common cause with trade unions, lending their moral authority to denounce sweatshops, back a higher minimum wage, and help organize janitors and poultry workers. The clergy has not yet lined up with labor to such an extent since the heyday of Cesar Chavez, the charismatic farm workers leader, in the 1970s, and perhaps the Depression." There was at least the beginning of a rebellion against the domination of the mass media by corporate wealth. Financial mergers had created super monopolies in television, the press, publishing. In 1994, a television station in San Francisco initially refused to air Deadly Deception, an Academy Award-winning documentary that exposed the General Electric Corporation's involvement in the nuclear weapons industry. Activists projected the entire film on the side of the television station's building and invited the community to watch. The station yielded and agreed to show the film. Disillusionment with both Democratic and Republican parties led in the mid-90s to a number of attempts to create independent political movements. In Texas, there was a founding convention of the Alliance for Democracy, which hoped to initiate a new anti-corporate populist movement in the country. In the Midwest, the new party sprang up to give voters an alternative to conservative candidates. Rank-and-file trade unionists from across the nation met in 1996 to set up a labor party. Would these elements come together in the next century, the next millennium, to fulfill their promise? No one could predict. All one could do was to act on the possibility, knowing that inaction would make any prediction a gloomy one. If democracy was to be given any meaning, if it was to go beyond the limits of capitalism and nationalism, this would not come, if history was any guide, from the top. It would come through citizens' movements, organizing, agitating, striking, boycotting, demonstrating, threatening those in power with disruption of the stability they needed. Sometime in 1992, the Republican Party held a dinner to raise funds for which individuals and corporations paid up to $400,000 to attend. The fee for Democratic dinners was slightly less. A White House spokesman told questioning reporters, "It's buying access to the system, yes." When asked about people who didn't have so much money, he replied, "They have to demand access in other ways." That may have been a clue to Americans wanting real change. They would have to demand access in their own way.
I am often asked how I came to create this work. One answer is that my wife Rosalyn urged me to write it, and continued to urge me at those times when, daunted by the magnitude of the project, I wanted to abandon it. Another is that the circumstances of my own life, which has spanned a fourth of the nation's history, a startling thought, demanded of me that I try to fashion a new kind of history. By that I mean a history different from what I had learned in college and in graduate school and what I saw in the history texts given to students all over the country. When I set out to write this history, I had been teaching history and what is grandiosely called political science for 20 years. Half of that time I was involved in the civil rights movement in the South, mostly while teaching at Spelman College in Atlanta, Georgia. And then there were 10 years of activity against the war in Vietnam. These experiences were hardly a recipe for neutrality in the teaching and writing of history. But my partisanship was undoubtedly shaped even earlier by my upbringing in a family of working-class immigrants in New York, by my 3 years as a shipyard worker, and my Air Force duty as a bombardier in the European theater, a strange word for that, theater, in the Second World War. That was all before I went to college under the GI Bill of Rights and began to study history. By the time I began teaching and writing, I had no illusions about objectivity, if that meant avoiding a point of view. I knew that a historian, or a journalist, or anyone telling a story, was forced to choose out of an infinite number of facts what to present, what to omit. And that decision inevitably would reflect, whether consciously or not, the interests of the historian. There is a certain drumbeat of scolding one hears these days about the need for students to learn facts. "Our young people are not being taught facts," said a presidential candidate, and candidates are always so scrupulous about facts, to a gathering of American Legionnaires. I was reminded of the character in Dickens' Hard Times, the pedant Gradgrind, who admonished a younger teacher, "Teach nothing but facts, facts, facts." But there is no such thing as a pure fact, innocent of interpretation. Behind every fact presented to the world by a teacher, a writer, anyone, is a judgment. The judgment that has been made is that this fact is important and that other facts omitted are not important. There were themes of profound importance to me, which I found missing in the orthodox histories that dominated American culture. The consequence of those omissions has been not simply to give a distorted view of the past, but more important, to mislead us all about the present. For instance, there is the issue of class. It is pretended that, as in the preamble to the Constitution, it is "we the people" who wrote that document, rather than 55 privileged white males whose class interest required a strong central government. That use of government for class purposes, to serve the needs of the wealthy and powerful, has continued throughout American history down to the present day. It is disguised by language that suggests all of us, rich and poor and middle class, have a common interest. Thus, the state of the nation is described in universal terms. The novelist Kurt Vonnegut invented the term "grand falloon" to describe a great bubble that must be punctured to see the complexity inside. When the president declares happily that "our economy is sound," he will not acknowledge that it is not at all sound for 40 or 50 million people who are struggling to survive, although it may be moderately sound for many in the middle class, and extremely sound for the richest 1% of the nation who own 40% of the nation's wealth. Labels are given to periods in our history which reflect the well-being of one class and ignore the rest. When I was going through the files of Fiorello LaGuardia, who, as a congressman in the 20s, represented East Harlem, I read the letters of desperate housewives, their husbands out of work, their children hungry, unable to pay their rent. all this in that period known as the Jazz Age, the Roaring Twenties. What we learn about the past does not give us absolute truth about the present, but it may cause us to look deeper than the glib statements made by political leaders and the experts quoted in the press. Class interest has always been obscured behind an all-encompassing veil called the national interest. My own war experience and the history of all those military interventions in which the United States was engaged made me skeptical when I heard people in high political office invoke the national interest or national security to justify their policies. It was with such justifications that Truman initiated a police action in Korea that killed several million people, that Johnson and Nixon carried out a war in Indochina in which perhaps 3 million people died, that Reagan invaded Grenada, Bush attacked Panama and then Iraq, and Clinton bombed Iraq again and again. Is there indeed a national interest when a few people decide on war and huge numbers of others, here and abroad, are killed or crippled as a result of such a decision? Should citizens not ask again and again, in whose interest are we doing what we are doing? Then why not, I came to think, tell a story of wars, not through the eyes of the generals and diplomats, but from the viewpoint of the GIs, of the parents who received the blackboarded telegrams, even of the enemy. What struck me as I began to study history was how nationalist fervor, inculcated from childhood on by pledges of allegiance, national anthems, flags waving, rhetoric blowing, permeated the educational systems of all countries, including our own. I wonder now how the foreign policies of the United States would look if we wiped out the national boundaries of the world, at least in our minds, and thought of all children everywhere as our own. Then we could never drop an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, or napalm on Vietnam, or indeed wage war anywhere, because wars, especially in our time, are always wars against children, indeed our children. And then there is, much as we would want to erase it, the ineradicable issue of race. It did not occur to me when I first began to immerse myself in history how badly twisted was the teaching and writing of history by its submersion of non-white people. Yes, Indians were there and then gone. Black people were visible when slaves, then free and invisible. It was a white man's history. From first grade to graduate school, I was given no inkling that the landing of Christopher Columbus in the New World initiated a genocide in which the indigenous population of Hispaniola was annihilated, or that this was just the first stage of what was presented as a benign expansion of the new nation. Louisiana Purchase, Florida Purchase, Mexican Cession, but which involved the violent expulsion of Indians, accompanied by unspeakable atrocities from every square mile of the continent until there was nothing to do with them but herd them into reservations. I was invited sometime in 1998 to speak at a symposium in Boston's historic Faneuil Hall on the Boston Massacre. I said I would be glad to do that so long as I did not have to deal with the Boston Massacre. And so my talk was not about the killing of 5 colonists by British troops in 1770. I thought that had been given an inordinate amount of attention for over 200 years because it served a certain patriotic function. Instead, I wanted to talk about the many massacres of non-white people in our history, which would not reinforce patriotic pride, but remind us of the long legacy of racism in our country, still smoldering and needing attention. Every American schoolchild learns about the Boston Massacre. But who learns about the massacre of 600 men, women, and children of the Pequot tribe in New England in 1637, or the massacre in the midst of the Civil War of hundreds of Indian families at Sand Creek, Colorado, by U.S. soldiers, or the military attack by 200 U.S. cavalrymen in 1870, which wiped out a sleeping camp of Piegan Indians in Montana. It was not until I joined the faculty of Spelman College, a college for black women in Atlanta, Georgia, that I began to read the African-American historians who never appeared on my reading lists in graduate school. W.E.B. Du Bois, Rayford Logan, Lawrence Reddick, Horace Mann Bond, John Hope Franklin. Nowhere in my history education had I learned about the massacres of black people that took place again and again amid the silence of a national government pledged by the Constitution to protect equal rights for all. For instance, in East St. Louis, 1917, there occurred one of the many race riots that took place in what our white-oriented history books called the Progressive Era. There, white workers, angered by the influx of black workers, killed perhaps 200 people, provoking an angry article by W.E.B. Du Bois called The Massacre of East St. Louis, and causing the performing artist Josephine Baker to say, "The very idea of America makes me shake and tremble and gives me nightmares." I wanted, in writing this book, to awaken a greater consciousness of class conflict, racial injustice, sexual inequality, and national arrogance. But even as I tried to make up for what I saw as serious omissions, I nevertheless neglected groups in American society that had always been missing from orthodox histories. I became aware of this and embarrassed by it when people wrote to me after reading A People's History, praising the book but pointing gently, sometimes not so gently, to its shortcomings. It was perhaps my stronger connection to the East Coast of the United States that caused me to ignore the large numbers of Latino and Latina people who lived in California and the Southwest and their struggles for justice. Readers who want to learn more about that might look into these extraordinary books. De Colores Means All of Us by Elizabeth Martinez. Zapata's Disciple, essays by Martin Espada. Aztlan and Vietnam, Chicano and Chicana Experiences of the War, edited by George Mariscal. And I suppose it was my own sexual orientation that accounted for my minimal treatment of the issue of gay and lesbian rights. I tried, when a new edition appeared in 1995, to make up for this, but readers will have to look further to get a more substantial account of the remarkable change in the national culture that took place when men and women who were queer, a pejorative term for some people, an honorable one for others, asserted their humanity boldly, courageously, to the larger society. As we pass from one century to another, one millennium to another, we would like to think that history itself is transformed as dramatically as the calendar. It rushes on as it always did, with two forces racing towards the future, one splendidly uniformed, the other ragged but inspired. There is the past and its continuing horrors, violence, war, prejudices against those who are different, outrageous monopolization of the good earth's wealth by a few, political power in the hands of liars and murderers, the building of prisons instead of schools, the poisoning of the press and the entire culture by money. It is easy to become discouraged observing this, especially since this is what the press and television insist that we look at and nothing more. But there is also, although much of this is kept from us to keep us intimidated and without hope, the bubbling of change under the surface of obedience, the growing revulsion against the endless wars. I think of the Russian women in the 90s, demanding their country end its military intervention in Chechnya, as did Americans during the Vietnam War. The insistence of women all over the world that they will no longer tolerate abuse and subordination. We see, for instance, the new international movement against female genital mutilation, and the militancy of welfare mothers against punitive laws. There is civil disobedience against the military machine, protest against police brutality directed especially at people of color. In the United States, we see the educational system, a burgeoning new literature, alternative radio stations, a wealth of documentary films outside the mainstream, even Hollywood itself and sometimes television compelled to recognize the growing multiracial character of the nation. Yes, we have in this country, dominated by corporate wealth and military power and two antiquated political parties, what a fearful conservative characterized as a permanent adversarial culture, challenging the present, demanding a new future. It is a race in which we can all choose to participate or just to watch. But we should know that our choice will help determine the outcome. I think of the words of the poet Shelley, recited by women garment workers in New York to one another at the turn of the century. Rise like lions after slumber in unvanquishable number. Shake your chains to earth like dew which in sleep had fallen on you. Ye are many, they are few.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. To order additional cassettes or to receive a complete catalog of Harper Audio and Cadman titles, please call us at 1-800-331-3761. That's 1-800-331-3761. Thank you.
In New Mexico, Latinos fought for land and water rights against real estate developers who tried to throw them off land they had lived on for decades. In 1988, there was a confrontation, and the people organized an armed occupation, built bunkers for protection against attack, and won support from other communities in the Southwest. Finally, a court ruled in their favor. Abnormal rates of cancer for farm workers in California aroused the Chicano community. Cesar Chavez of the United Farm Workers fasted for 35 days in 1988 to call attention to these conditions. There were now United Farm Workers unions in Texas, Arizona, and other states. The importation of Mexican workers for low wages, under terrible conditions, spread from the Southwest to other parts of the country. By 1991, 80,000 Latinos lived in North Carolina, 30,000 in North Georgia. The Farm Labor Organizing Committee, which had won a difficult strike in the Ohio tomato fields in 1979, the largest agricultural strike ever in the Midwest, brought thousands of farm workers together in several Midwest states. As the Latino population of the country kept growing, it soon matched the 12% of the population that was African American and began to have a distinct effect on American culture. Much of its music, art, and drama was much more consciously political and satirical than mainstream culture. The Border Arts Workshop was formed in 1984 by artists and writers in San Diego and Tijuana, and its work dealt powerfully with issues of racism and injustice. In Northern California, Teatro Campesino and Teatro de la Esperanza performed for working people all over the country, turning schoolhouses, churches, and fields into theaters. Latinos were especially conscious of the imperial role the United States had played in Mexico and the Caribbean, and many of them became militant critics of U.S. policy toward Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Cuba. In 1970, a great march in Los Angeles against the Vietnam War, which had been attacked by police, left three Chicanos dead. When the Bush administration was preparing for war against Iraq in the summer of 1990, thousands of people in Los Angeles marched along the same route they had taken 20 years before when they were protesting the Vietnam War. As Elizabeth Martinet wrote, 500 Years of Chicano History in Pictures, before enduring President Bush's war in the Persian Gulf, many people, including Raza, literally race, a term adopted by Latino activists, had doubts about it or were opposed. We had learned some lessons about wars started in the name of democracy that turned out to benefit only the rich and powerful. Raza mobilized to protest this war of mass murder even faster than the U.S. war in Vietnam, though we could not stop it. In 1992, a fundraising group which came out of the Vietnam War called Resist made donations to 168 organizations around the country, community groups,